This is day four of this April 2011 7-day session. I will resume with the teachings of Japanese Zen Master Dogen as presented in a book with the title A Primer of Soto Zen. And this is a translation of his informal talks by Reiho Masunaga. On another occasion, Dogen instructed, "The student must, above all, separate himself from concepts of the self. To separate from views of the self means not to cling to this body. Even though you study deeply the sayings of the old masters and practice Zazen, remaining as immobile as stone or iron, you will never gain the way of the Buddhas and patriarchs, even if you try for endless eons, unless you can free yourself from attachment to the body." This first sentence must above all separate oneself from concepts of the self. And they're so insidious, these concepts of the self. They manifest in subtle ways. The most obvious are thought sentences that involve I or me, but less obvious, but also that involve the self are those that involve my. And maybe the most treacherous is my practice. To be thinking about my practice is to be involved in thoughts of the self. Very common snare that people get into. There is no need to think about my practice. All there is just a two-step thing. Noticing when the mind has drifted, that's one. And then once you've noticed, going back to the practice, the breath, the koan, whatever. Nowhere is it called for to think about, to formulate the notion of my practice. But this is what catches so many of us. Usually, it's in terms of progress or regress. I'm getting somewhere. I'm not getting somewhere. It's the same thing. It's involvement with the concept of the self. I'm getting somewhere. I'm not getting somewhere. My practice is such and such compared to other people's. It's better, it's worse. These are the shoals that on which one's practice so often runs aground. But then he goes on and makes it more specific. To separate from views of the self means not to cling to this body. By clinging to the body, certainly he's talking about dwelling in thoughts of one's pain. That would be one obvious thing. It's such a mistake to be thinking about one's pain or to be strategizing or it's all a form of separation. It's all involvement with the concept of self. to be worried about pain that might be coming. That's another version of it. Well, if I sit, if I do yaza, night sitting, then I may have pain in the morning. Or if I do yaza, I may be drowsy tomorrow. There's another form of attachment to the body. Really, any concern, it's always self-concern, any self-concern about the comfort or discomfort would fall under this category of clinging to the body. Here in our sesshins, as strong as they are, and I think they are exceptionally taught, strict, intense sesshins compared to sesshins at other places, and I've been to some of those other places, even in Japan, still there is a lot of concessions to comfort here. Starting with all the tremendous variety and abundance of cushions that one can use to be more comfortable. We've thought this through over the years, and we feel that that's not a place where we need to deprive people of. If you can get yourself arranged, if you find the right combination of cushions to get yourself arranged, then it will help you, it seems. It will help you deal with whatever pain there is beyond that. The temperature is so moderate here, certainly compared to Japan. Goes on, no matter how well you say you know the true and provisional teachings or the esoteric and exoteric doctrines, as long as you possess a mind that clings to the body, you will be vainly counting others' treasures without gaining even half a cent for yourself. I ask only that you students sit quietly and examine with true insight the beginnings and end of this human body. The body, hair, and skin are the products of the union of our parents. When the breathing stops, the body is scattered amid mountains and fields and finally turns to earth and mud. Why then do you attach to this body? Viewed from the Buddhist standpoint, the body is no more than the accumulation and dispersal of the 18 realms of sense. Which realm should we pick out and identify as our body? While differences exist between Zen and other teachings, they agree in that in the practice of the way, emphasis is placed on the impermanence of the human body. Once you penetrate this truth, the true Dharma manifests itself clearly. In another talk, Dogen said, for the first time at this monastery, I have today appointed a meditation director and have asked him to take up the whisk and lecture. Apparently, that was the tradition at his monastery, was the sign of a teacher's authority, is this horsehair whisk that I use in ceremonies. Don't let the smallness of this assembly or the fact that this is his first lecture bother you. The group around Fan Yang amounted to only 6 or 7 persons. Yao Shan had less than 10 disciples under him, yet they all practiced the way of the Buddhas and the patriarchs. A time like this, they say, is when a monastery flourishes. These are two great masters, Fan Yang and Yao Shan. Now, there's no safety in numbers to have large numbers of people. There's no proof of quality. We know this from these immense mega churches. That can draw thousands of people on a single Sunday. It's because of human attachment to the body, clinging to the body and the comforts, grasping at comfort and avoiding discomfort, that a practice or a discipline like Zen that demands relinquishment of such attachments, that this would never be particularly popular. Most people don't want to give up their comforts, their pleasures. And then he says, think of those who gained enlightenment upon hearing the sound of bamboo when struck by a tile, or on seeing blossoms in bloom. These are two famous examples. The first one was Kyogen. I forget his Chinese name. He came to awakening when he was sweeping outdoors and the broom flicked a little pebble against a tile and made a loud crack, and that's when he came to realization. And the other one is also famous. It's unusual visual trigger of awakening is seeing blossoms bloom. Then he goes on. Does the bamboo distinguish the clever or dull, the deluded or enlightened? Does the flower differentiate between the shallow and deep, the wise and stupid? Though flowers bloom year after year, not everyone who sees them gains enlightenment. Bamboos always give off sounds, but not all who hear them become enlightened. I mean, there's a stage in my practice I'd heard about an awakening accounts where the master would clout the student. And student would come to awakening, and every time I would knock my head against something, I would get excited, thinking, I'm ready, let's bring it on. It is only by the virtue of long practice under a teacher and much additional practice that we gain an affinity with what we have labored for and gain enlightenment and clarity of mind. This does not mean that the sound of bamboo itself has a penetrating effectiveness or that the color of flowers is surpassingly beautiful. I think he's uh, This is a metaphor. He's speaking indirectly that it's not just about the quality of the teacher. Although the sound of bamboo may be wondrous, it does not sound of itself, but must wait for the tile that causes the sound to arise. Although the color of flowers may be beautiful, they do not bloom of themselves, but must wait for the spring wind that opens them. Well, he could also be talking about the student, that it's neither just the student nor just the teacher. It's the teacher and student working together and their affinity at that particular time. In the same way, the practice of the way must have a cause. Although each individual inherently possesses the way, the gaining of it depends on all the monks practicing together. Although an individual may have a brilliant mind, the practice of the way depends on the strength of many. See, this is the great emphasis on communities sitting together. This has been Zen from the beginning, is people sitting together, not dispersed, but sitting together. This pooling of energy generates the kind of samadhi power that we're already starting to get into as the days pass. Therefore, unifying your minds and concentrating your determination, practice under a teacher and seek the way. Jewels become objects of beauty by polishing. Man becomes a true man by training. What jewel is lustrous from the beginning? What person is superior from the outset? You must always keep polishing and always keep training. Do not deprecate yourselves and relax in your practice of the way. An old master said, "Do not spend your time wastefully." And then Dogen says, "I ask you, is time something that will stop if you value it? Or is it something that cannot be stopped, no matter how you value it? This you must understand. It is not time that passes in vain, but people who pass their time in vain. Neither time nor people should be wasted. Devote yourselves to the practice of the way." Here Dogen is warning about idle chatter. When ordinary men and women get together, whether young or old, they very often chat about things of a most improper nature. This diverts their minds and makes for lively conversation. It gives them enjoyment and serves to alleviate boredom, but this kind of talk is expressly forbidden for monks. Even among lay people, it rarely occurs when good, sober, and courteous people gather to discuss serious problems. Usually it is associated with drunkenness and dissipation. Monks must concentrate on the Dharma alone. Indecent talk is indulged in only by a few confused and eccentric monks. Even in the temples of China, there is no such problem, since the monks do not engage in trivial talk. Even in Japan, while Eisai was still alive, such talk was never engaged in. Even after his death, while a few of his disciples were still at the temple, there was virtually no idle conversation. In the past 7 or 8 years, however, some of the younger people have started to engage in small talk, a most regrettable affair. Now, this may strike some of you as a little extreme, but it really makes a difference in a training environment. That's why we maintain silence in Sesshin. It really makes a difference in terms of one's ability to practice if there isn't excessive, unnecessary talk, idle conversation that goes on and on. I've tried and tried at the center with the staff to get people to at least reduce the amount of idle talk at informal meals and tea breaks. There's too often a kind of compulsive quality to it, and the volume, it can get so completely out of control, but it seems to be very difficult for people to restrain themselves in this way. It's one of the things that, sure, you could talk all day long, every day, for weeks, and still come to awakening, because in our inherent nature, we are already awakened. Enlightenment is our nature, so nothing can deny that fact. This is our nature. But little things matter. Little things, we stitch together habits of speech and act and behavior that cumulatively, over time, do have their effect. They take their toll on our ability, say when we come to Sesshin, to let go of thoughts, words. One thing I have done to address this is just to have an extra formal meal. I don't feel we need to have a lunch every day as a formal meal in silence, but at least there's one more than there used to be, because that's at least one way to enable people to have the silence to work on their practice in while eating. That's, of course, the whole point of it. It's not there's anything wrong with talking. It's that you can't work on your koan and talk at the same time. That's the point. It's that simple. In a talk one evening, Dogen said, "In this world, both laymen and monks tend to publicize their good deeds and hide the bad ones. Because of this, their inner and outer lives do not correspond. They should try somehow to bring together their inner and outer selves. You should secretly do good when no one is watching, and if you do wrong, you should confess and repent. In this way, good acts done in secret will be rewarded. Open confession of wrongdoing removes the crime so that benefits naturally accrue in this present world and in future lives as well." This strikes right to the heart of human nature, is wanting to be seen, as virtuous and wanting to conceal one's other actions. But what he says is very profound. That we, to the degree that we do this, we create a split in our nature, and a disintegration. And by doing practices like this, and this is the standard practice in Zen training, is repentance, where you openly acknowledge your failings, the things you've done, said that caused harm to others. And then the other side is when doing something helpful, good for others, to not look for credit. There's this thing called hidden virtue that Dogen talks about, where you do something helpful for someone else without letting them know that you did it. This generates real merit in terms of good karma for oneself. There are some who, although they've escaped from the world and concealed themselves deep in mountain forests, cannot break with a family that has continued over many generations, nor can they keep from thinking of the members of their family and their relatives. This would be, I think it's fair to say, especially tempting in a Confucian society where familial bonds are very much respected and nurtured. There are others who have broken free from world, family, and the influence of relatives, yet concern themselves with their own bodies and avoid anything that brings pain. They are reluctant to undertake any training that might endanger their health. Such people have yet to cast aside their bodies. Then there are those who undergo hard training without regard for their own bodies, yet withhold their minds from the Dharma. They reject any aspect of the Dharma that does not match their preconceptions. Such people have yet to cast aside their minds. Well, of the two, this attachment to the body or the attachment to the mind, the second one is probably more difficult to get through. With attachment to the body, if you have enough commitment and discipline, you can work with that. You can experiment with getting less sleep or less food. You can exert yourself in different ways to break that attachment. With attachment to mental things, it's particularly difficult because our most formidable mental attachments are not known to us. They're so much woven into our view of reality that we don't think of them as attachments. We just imagine that that's how the world is. That's how the way we see things is the way things are. This is very hard to overcome. And that's where working with a teacher can be so helpful, is because a teacher can give you the feedback and help you see what would otherwise remain invisible to you. Teacher has the advantage, of course, of working with lots of people, and so for any given student, their particular mental attachment can be especially glaring, and this is feedback that the teacher can give the student. But even doing so, in my experience, pointing out such a thing, the student will all too often just blink and say, you know, in their mind, say, okay, whatever. Mostly, we just have to have this be revealed through Zazen. Roshi Kaplow was once lamenting that the advice he gives to people, so often they won't take it. He said, I don't even know why I give. This was about regarding personal advice. People wondering about relationships or how to proceed in a relationship or whether to do this or not do that. And he said, I don't even know why I give advice to people about their personal lives, because they so often ignore it. And he said, wait, I think I do know why, because then when they see that I was right, you know, over time, when they see that I was right in my advice, then they have more faith in me as a teacher. Yes, Zazen is much more powerful antidote to our mental attachments than anything anyone can say, even one's own teacher. It's through Zazen that these things are revealed for what they are, just acquired notions that we've picked up and that we've had for so long that they've sort of gotten tattooed on the mind, these attachments. There's a little game we play. The last few years we've played at on the Buddha's birthday weekend, where we will there's a group of people, and one of them will have the name of a famous person on a sticky piece of paper applied to their forehead, like whatever, Cleopatra. And they have to guess, and so they can't see it themselves because it's right against their forehead, and then other people have to give clues until they get it. Well, this is sort of what a lot of our mental attachments are. They're right against our forehead, so we don't see them, and we don't even believe that they're there when they're pointed out, and that can, you know, cause arguments and defensiveness. What do you mean? What do you mean? This is where marriage can really be a wonderful form of practice, is in one's trust, deep trust and love of one's spouse. Every once in a while you believe what he or she is telling you that you need to work on in yourself, when you've heard it enough times. Ideally, it's with one's spouse or one's children that you can not just react defensively, but can trust that it is offered in a spirit of wanting to help. This is one that always has always stuck in my mind. This is one of the, I think I said this the first day, this is one of the very few texts, Zen texts, translated into English that poor Roshi Kaplow had to read from in Taisho. There were only four or five books at that time. And so I heard this book read many, many times. But this is one that stuck with me more than anything. He quotes his own teacher, Eisai. The late Abbot Eisai always used to tell us, "Don't think that I'm the one who gives you the clothing and food that you use. I only get them and pass them on to you." He's, of course, addressing his monks. But here's the part that I meant. When one thinks about it, everyone has his allotted share of food and clothing while he is alive. It does not come from thinking about it, nor does one fail to get it because one does not seek for it. Laymen leave such matters to fate while they concern themselves with loyalty and develop their filial piety. How much less, then, should monks be governed by worldly concerns? Each person naturally receives his allotted share in his life. He need not think of it. He need not search for it. The allotted portion is there. Even if you rush about in search of riches, what happens when death suddenly comes? Students should clear their minds of these non-essential things and concentrate on practicing the way. Just consider for a minute, if you really had faith in this, each person naturally receives his allotted share in his life. He need not think of it, he need not search for it, the allotted portion is there. If you could really have faith in that, how freeing it would be. How much it would free you of grasping and anxiety about never having enough, never having enough, worrying about the future. On another occasion, Dogen said, many people today think that the making of Buddha figures and the building of pagodas cause the Dharma to prosper. This is not so. No one gained the way by erecting lofty buildings that have gleaming jewels and gold adornments. This may sound extreme, but there have always been major temples and monasteries in China and Japan and Korea that had literally had gleaming jewels and gold as part of it. I just heard about a monk, senior monk at a temple in China, one of the ones that our group of pilgrims visited last summer, called Bailin Monastery. Well, this monk is building several major monasteries in Canada, and one of them, his disciple told me, the one he's working on now has a bronze roof that's guaranteed for 1,000 years. And he said it's going to be built entirely of rosewood, this monastery. Here Dogen is warning about this kind of thing. He says, this merely is a good action that gives blessings or merit by bringing lay treasures into the Buddhist world. Although small causes can have large effects, the Dharma does not prosper if monks engage in such activities. If you learn one phrase of the Buddhist teaching or practice Zazen even for a moment in a thatched hut or even under a tree, the Dharma will truly flourish. I am now trying to build a monastery and I'm asking people for contributions. While this requires much effort on my part, I cannot believe that it necessarily stimulates the Dharma. It is just that nowadays there is no one who wants to practice the Dharma, and I have much time on my hands. Okay, we'll just keep going. Since there is no place now for them to study, I want to provide a place for students to practice Zazen. Should any deluded followers appear who might wish to establish a connection with a Dharma? If my plans do not work out, I will have no regrets. If I can put up just one pillar, I won't care if people see it later and think that I had a plan but was unable to carry it out. But what would that have to do with us? Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.